Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Ready? One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Iditapod. It's a podcast about, you know, the Iditarod. Brought to you by Alaska Public Media and KNOM in Nome. Before we really kick things off here, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
I am joined again in the studio by Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes. Hello, Zach.
Hello, Casey.
And KNOM's Ben Matheson. Hi, Ben.
Hey, Casey.
And today was the ceremonial start of the Iditarod in downtown Anchorage through Anchorage. Guys, thousands of people, hundreds of dogs. It's not really the start of the Iditarod, but it really symbolizes it, and it kicks things off. How did it go down there?
It was gloriously sunny, warm, full of people. You could see the dog's breath. Everyone had their finest furs on, and I think everyone knew that this was a classic Iditarod start and the set to a classic Iditarod race.
Conditions were great. I mean, it was cold enough that the snow was kind of sticking together, wasn't melting into mush. It felt smaller than past years. You know, it is a smaller number of mushers with 52. And just reporting on a lot of that, it felt like a much more manageable size. And the ceremonial starts great for reporters because all the mushers have to be there. So it's one of the only opportunities when you can literally find everybody that you might want to talk to and interview them. So Ben and I were both trying to get interviews with people about what they're expecting, how their dog teams are looking, their thoughts about some rule changes going from 16 dogs to 14 this year. So just a lot of trying to get as many interviews as you can. Some of them are literally 40 or 50 seconds because the mushers are really busy at different points, getting their dogs ready. It's a hectic environment. Some of them are a little bit more substantive and a little bit longer.
There's a certain routine and ceremony to doing the start of the Iditarod, and there's a number of questions that we always ask to gather some intel on what dogs are rookies, what do your leaders look like, what are you excited about. I was really trying to get into Musher's headspace about what really brought out some emotion and what brought out where they're really putting their mental energy, especially for Mushers who have done this several times. Where are they truly thinking about things?
Zach, real quick, describe for me what a routine Iditarod ceremonial start is like downtown.
Sure. It bears literally no resemblance to any other part of the Iditarod. You know, the Iditarod is notorious for going through some of the most remote parts of Alaska, and this is in probably the closest Alaska has to a dense, you know, cluttered population center. It's on a downtown street. It's on 4th Avenue. On that backdrop, you've got the main street and then some side streets where teams are lined out. Mushers have their dog trucks there. They're getting their dogs ready. And after that, it's kind of a parade type thing where mushers are leaving every 2 minutes. They've got these things called Iditariders. It's folks that have won an auction to get to sit and travel with particular mushers. So they're there. They're waving. The mushers are waving. They've got handlers around. It's boisterous. There's crowds on the streets. And it's not at all like what a normal checkpoint is like or what most of the race is like. And that's good and bad. It's actually a lot more like fun and spirited in a lot of ways.
This is the distillation of Alaska iconic imagery into the 2 hours that Alaska puts on its finest show in terms of dogs, furs, food, outdoor, party, trails. It's the whole package together.
It's definitely the biggest winter event in Anchorage and maybe all of Alaska, really, in one place as far as the ceremonial start goes. And you've got thousands of people there cheering them on. And then a little bit farther down the trail, things kind of spread out, but people have their spots that they go watch the race. And that's kind of what I was checking in on and just kind of went, you know, do a couple, two, three, four of those different little gatherings that people have out on the trail. Talk to some folks, you know, they're out there grilling hot dogs and other food and definitely having some beverages and watching the mushers go by, and they kind of spreads out a little bit more, and then they end up about 12 miles away from downtown at Campbell Airstrip.
Well, and one other thing that I just want to mention is it's also kind of a political spectacle in Alaska. You've got the mayor of Anchorage makes an appearance, the governor, new governor, Mike Dunleavy is walking around. I've got a little bit of tape that I just want to play of another person who was literally just kind of wandering around the streets.
Senator, who do you think is going to, who are you cheering for?
Oh, I am cheering for every dog that's running the Iditarod.
So that's senior U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. She was walking around in this glamorous full-length fur coat with an ornate ruff. talking to her friends, talking to mushers that she knows, talking to constituents, talking to reporters, and not about any particularly hard stuff, but, you know, the Iditarod is an important enough event in Alaska that literally our highest politicians come in, make a show, they dress up.
Lisa Murkowski, unlike some of the other politicians that were around, she actually rode on a tag sled behind Jeff King's sled, and some people thought that was interesting. I have some tape of that as well.
Tell me what just happened there.
I just high-fived Lisa Murkowski. Yeah, I didn't know about that. I thought I was just high-fiving some random lady. That was pretty awesome.
It's a senator.
Yeah, it's just a senator. No big deal.
So that young lady was very excited to have high-fived Lisa Murkowski sliding by on a sled. We saw a picture, too, from, I think, the ADN, where she was actually making a turn on the sled, just like Jeff. She looked like she was really dog-mushing there, right, Ben?
That was not a simulated picture. That looked like you're going around a turn with 12 or 14 dogs that are going with all their excitement. That was real dog mushing.
I don't know how many other U.S. senators could handle a 14-dog turn around a sharp corner. But, you know, it's part of what's fun about the ceremonial start, to me at least, is that it's kind of campy. There's a little bit of kitsch. There's a little bit of, you know, knowing that it's silly to be in downtown Anchorage with a, you know, a heavy fur coat, even though it's 20 degrees in the sunshine, fur hats that are absolutely over the top. And I think the people that are wearing them would say, you know, this is probably the only time they're wearing a, you know, a lynx pelt or a fox head as a hat. But it's kind of like everyone's in on the joke. Like everyone, I think, thinks it's a little over the top and silly. And it's one of the only times I'll say that I feel like Anchorage is actually a major part of Alaska.
Out on the trail, there were a lot of people with different costumes on. There was one party that was sort of a Wild West, you know, cowboy-themed party. And then there were just some random ones, monkeys. There was a penguin. And then also this gentleman.
Can you, sir, can you describe what you're wearing?
I am currently in a banana costume. I'm holding and clutching some bananas in my hand to give out to some of the mushers. Hopefully they enjoy them. They need some potassium on the road ahead, so, you know.
A lot of hot dogs and beer and stuff out there, but you have like a healthy alternative.
That is correct, yeah. I want to be a little keto friendly, a little more like, you know, watch their diet, help them out a little bit on the road, you know.
So there's a lot of dressing up that goes on.
It's just silly.
Yeah, it is. You know, guys, there's something I kind of want to get off my chest a little bit, and that's that I think we and a lot of people get real caught up in the horse race or the dog race of it, you could say. And we just, you know, it's good to kind of step back and remember that this is a wilderness race across all of Alaska, just about 1,000 miles across Alaska anyway. And it's a big deal for these guys to even try to finish the race. And so as we continue, we're going to hear more stories from some of those mushers that are not necessarily at the front of the pack, but we're going to be, you know, following just the survival aspect of this race, which is always important to remember. That being said, who did you guys talk to downtown this morning?
I spoke with Matt Hall. He was one of the top placing rookies last year, one of the few mushers who completed the Yukon Quest, and a really promising, bright young musher. I was talking to him about his strategy for making a clean run through the Alaska Range and where the real racing begins. Matt told me a story about his 2018 run in which he was really taking it easy during the first part of the race.
You know, so I'm going 8 miles an hour, not even an hour and a half into the race. You know, you're still passing all these spectators, and about five teams had passed me at that point. And there's this group on the side of the trail, and they're like, "You're okay, Matt. Don't scratch. Just don't scratch. You can catch up." You know, I started chuckling. I'm like, no. This is part of the plan. You take it easy early on.
I just thought it was a hilarious story.
He's like a seasoned musher for a young guy who was a rookie last year, and definitely will be watching him. How about you, Zach?
One of the interesting conversations I had was with Martin Boozer about the difference between the northern route and the southern route, and just wanted to hear from Martin how he might prepare differently and what some of, from a musher's perspective, the big challenges and differences are between the two.
Well, the southern route incorporates a section of trail that is rarely used, so it kind of depends on what the Iditarod Trail Committee does with that particular portion, mostly from Ophir to Shagluck. Gets very, very little traffic, in part because it's such a pretty hungry country, cold and hungry. We can actually go days without seeing an animal track. So there's not a lot of trapping and not a lot of hunting going on in that neck of the woods. Iditarod was mainly a hub because of gold. Obviously, that's been depleted to some degree, and the town is abandoned. So there's no really need for a lot of traffic. And that can make it interesting and has made it interesting in years, or challenging or difficult or impassable for some people. So that's the difference. The northern route obviously is more traveled, including the Iron Dog people. So there is usually at least a base, if not chopped up by the snow machine traffic, but there's at least a base.
So when Martin's telling the southern route, which they're doing again this year like they did last year, a little bit more challenging, the trail can vary a little bit more, and there's more opportunities in that critical middle section around or immediately after people are taking their 24-hour rests for big moves to happen in some wide-open country.
So guys, this is a chance really to see all the mushers and their teams and all their equipment too in one place. What did you see there?
Defending champion Yor Leifseth Olsom had a special type of harness, and I verified with Pete Kaiser's dad, Ron Kaiser, that it was a novel thing. It was fur on the inside, kind of on the top shoulder of the harness. The idea was that the speculation was that that's to reduce rub, and that's a way to just reduce friction and do that, but we'd never seen that before.
For me, one of the big things was I wasn't looking too closely, because sometimes people will take the equipment that they are going to take on the trail, and other times they're using sleds that are maybe a little bit more performative, shall we say, or showy, or they've got to take, you know, multiple people, so they want something that's a little bit more stable. That being said, this year, Jeff King has a new design. Jeff is sort of known for pioneering different modifications with sleds, starting with, you know, cookers attached to the back and seats on it at one point, things that are much discussed and oftentimes derided when they first come out and then become the total norm. So this year, Jeff is experimenting with the sled design that he first used competitively at the K300 out in Bethel in January. It opens from, I don't know, it's hard to describe on the radio, but it opens from the top backwards. Sort of like, imagine a baby stroller. From where you're pushing the handlebars, there's a flap that you can then move up and backwards and then look down at the baby. It's like that, but in a sled bag, so that he can be standing on the back of his sled and not have any Velcro, not have any zippers, and open his sled and get really easy access into the bag. So I asked him about that.
For me, it's ease of getting in and out of it. If you realize how many times I realize there's something in my sled I want as I'm mushing down the trail, like my mittens or a hat or whatever, it's hard to reach out and unzip and get in, and this really does just open the entire contents up. Also, if I'm carrying a dog, it's going to give them head space and keep the bag off their head, and I'm quite confident they're more comfortable.
This is by no means like reinventing the sled and totally radical. That said, when I was looking at it, I was like, wow, that's a smart idea. I don't know why that's not been tried before. You know, ease of access, you know, get into your sled bag even when you're running.
There was this short period of time where people were using trailers behind the sleds, and that's not allowed anymore. But the sled is sort of, it needs to carry all your equipment and maybe a dog or two. But we are starting the Iditarod this year with actually fewer dogs than you were allowed to start last year. Tell me about that, Ben.
The limit this year is 14 dogs, and that's done for, I believe, a variety of reasons. The fewer dogs there are in checkpoints, the less dogs there are dropped over the course of the race. It makes things a little bit simpler in terms of going around sharp corners. The Yukon Quest, I believe, is a 14-dog race.
Yep.
The Kuskokwim 300 has been reduced down from 14 to 12. So there's been a bit of a broader trend in reducing the number of dogs.
It's just easier to take care of fewer dogs, right? It's fewer booties to put on them. It's less massaging you might have to do and ointment and whatnot.
I will say I heard some divided opinion from mushers. Some of them were pretty blasé about it, don't think it's going to matter. Others, and I think they would be fine with me saying this, the larger mushers think that it is an impediment to them that at a certain point, you know, folks that are getting past 160, 180 towards 200 pounds, those two extra dogs, particularly on uphill sections, does make a difference, that a, you know, that big of a team will have an impact, and don't really agree with the change. And I'll say the people that I spoke with, anecdotally, this was not a scientific study, but it was smaller mushers that were a little bit more in favor, and some of the more generously built mushers who were less
favorable.
That's a
nice way of saying that. This also sets up a situation where you have to choose your 14 rather than your 16, so it's a harder decision to make who you're bringing on the race, right?
I found that that was actually a really relevant topic that brought out some real serious emotion. I spoke with Allie Zirkel.
How hard was it for you to choose your 14?
I haven't chosen my 14. yet.
And I have to say, the one reason I played that was that I have never heard a more robust, hearty, and strong laugh out of one topic. I asked the same question to defending champion Your Life Seth Olsen.
Do you have your 14 dogs selected?
I don't. I'm still deciding on the last two.
Can't you just feel the anguish that the pistons that are pumping in his brain trying to figure out those last couple decisions?
And I think I've heard before, you know, that it's not necessarily about the performance of the dog over, you know, 1,000 miles. Of course, that matters. But people get attached to the dog. You know, they want them for emotional support. They're an animal that they've cared for this long. And sometimes having a dog in your team that just has a lot of heart is a big deal. And so that's a tough decision to make. So dog care changes maybe the number of dogs you have to care for. But there are some mushers that know more about dog care than others. And you talked to Jessica Klaka about that. She's a veterinarian. Is that right?
She's a practicing veterinarian. She's been around dogs all of her life. But as a practicing veterinarian, she brings a bit of a perspective that, as she tells me, makes her overthink things a little bit.
And so I see something happen, you know, like a dog, I toss him a piece of fish, and, you know, if he doesn't eat it right away, I start going, okay, wait, what's going on? Why doesn't he want to eat the fish? You know, and I'm like smelling the fish. Is it okay? You know? But for the most part, I think it's very advantageous because I can kind of calm a lot of, I get a lot of calls from mushers the last few weeks before I did Iditarod asking a lot of questions. And it's kind of fun because even the top people in the sport are still have a few questions beforehand, and most of them are ones that just, you know, your veterinarian knows the answer to, so it's kind of fun.
It's 1,000 miles across Alaska. It takes a lot of work to take care of your dogs, and it takes some work to take care of yourself, and probably nobody out there is going to be having to take care of themselves more than four-time champion Lance Mackey, who is back in the Iditarod this year. Tell me about that, Zach.
Lance Mackey last ran the Iditarod in 2016 and had a really difficult run and had to scratch. He was really upset about that. His health has been a serious issue. Even before this, he's sort of known for having survived cancer and gotten back into mushing and thrived. He's got a lot of health problems, but he said he didn't want to go out on a bad note like he did in 2016. And he's adamant, you know, he wants to finish.
Well, he's one of the toughest people maybe on earth. He had a finger removed because it hurt him so much. He survived cancer. He doesn't have salivary glands, so he has to squirt water in his mouth constantly. In his hands, because of that nerve damage and his Raynaud's syndrome, he has to try to keep those warm and then somehow take care of his dogs all the time with all the things you need fingers and thumbs for.
I think that one of the things of people who've never been around mushing don't realize is how damaged your fingers become if you are somebody who mushes over time. Even people who take care of their fingers, you know, frostbite never really goes away. And if you're constantly freezing and refreezing your fingers, they get really damaged. And a lot of dog mushing is manipulating clasps and harnesses and booties and opening zippers and all these really tactile things at 30, 40 below in a prolonged way. And so for Lance, who has poor circulation because of a medical condition, you know, there's a sort of constant pain that's just part and parcel to him taking care of his dogs. So he's sort of the perennial comeback. He's just endured so much. That's part of his story. And he's always got a really positive attitude. I mentioned to him when I saw him at the ceremonial start that this was the first time I'd seen him around dogs since the 2017 race when he was not competing. His brother was, but he was not. And he was just wandering around the dog yard. And I asked him, you know, how are you doing? And he said, you know, I've spent the entire day feeling like I'm about to cry. So I asked him today, you know, how does it feel to be back and starting with a lot of your friends and your dogs?
I almost feel nervous, to be honest with you. I almost feel like a rookie and it's my first time. But the adrenaline and the excitement of the avenue is the same for a 20-year veteran or a rookie, you know? If you're not nervous and people tell you, no, I'm not nervous, even today, they're BSing you. If you weren't nervous, you didn't have anything invested. Right? So, today is a little bit of a dress rehearsal, like Martin Boozer calls it. It's a show for the fans, the sponsors, and the state and beyond. And, you know, we're here to put them on a show. So, we're going to stop at every muffin stand. We're going to eat hot dogs and wash them down with beer.
Classic Lance Mackey answer. You know, we've heard that this may be his last Iditarod, and definitely... The guy has won his share, and it's a little bit like you're watching some great sports star and they're kind of in the sunset of their career. It's like watching Jerry Rice play his last game, maybe. We'll see.
What's your theory about Mushroom retirement?
Mushers never retire or even go away. They just go out back for a while.
And then they come back like Lance Mackey's comeback kennels. Well, there's one person who was wearing a comeback kennel sweatshirt waiting for Lance. I saw her in the same spot something like 10 years ago, maybe. This is Eleanor Frank. She was on the Chester Creek Trail just a little bit south of 16th Avenue.
And you've been coming to the spot for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been coming here since 2004.
Wow, yeah.
Same spot, 2004, yes.
And I think I know the answer to this, but who is your favorite musher?
Yeah, I'll show you. Oh, if I can.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
Oh, here he is, Lance Mackey.
Looking forward to seeing him this year?
Yep, I even have his beer for him.
What kind of beer?
What?
What kind of beer is it?
Milwaukee's Best.
So Lance Mackey likes that Milwaukee's Best. I saw him. One time he stopped, gave her a hug, took the beer, drank the beer, you know, just reveling in the whole ceremonial start of the Iditarod. It's interesting to see him back, and he's back here in the Iditarod.
Having fun and being Lance.
A lot of people love Lance Mackey. Still a lot of questions about how his race is going to go this year. And we're actually going to do a question now on the Iditapod. We take questions here. We got a bunch of them sent to us from Miss Ortiz's fourth grade class out in Unalaska. They come to us via our colleagues at member station KUCB. And they visited and helped the students break into groups. And they recorded a few things that they're wondering about.
My name is Justice. The question is, what do they do if the musher and the dogs get sick?
Thanks for the really good question, Justice. When dogs get sick, and that's often something that happens along the trail, the musher has to slow down a little bit and make sure they get the rest they need, make sure they're getting the right diet so there's not too much fat or too much protein or too much normal dog food. Whatever keeps their stomachs calm and keeps them eating so they're strong enough to run. But that happens. Dogs get sick. Mushers get sick too, and mushers aren't as good about taking care of themselves as they are taking care of their dogs. Mushers will usually just take a little bit of a nap, but really just stay on the trail.
And a lot of mushers get sick. I've seen your Alsem with a stomach flu just doubled over in McGrath one year, and, you know, there was no talk of taking a sick day or anything. It was just, man, now my 24-hour rest is going to be less restful, and they keep going. So I would definitely agree with Ben. Sometimes if a dog's too sick to keep going, they'll get what's called dropped, and then they're flown back to Anchorage or back to a larger place, and a handler takes them and helps them recuperate.
One other thing I would say kind of related to the start, most mushers are not going to tell you that their start order matters a ton to them, but one thing that can be affected by that is if dogs are sick in other teams ahead of yours on the trail and you pass by and your dogs get some kind of stomach bug, that's not good for you if you're farther back down the trail. So if you're up near the front, near the beginning, you can kind of avoid things for a time anyway. Well, Zach, Ben, this is the last time that we're going to see each other for a while, and I've really enjoyed these prequel episodes. We are now, of course, getting real close to the actual start of the Iditarod. That is in Willow, and you guys will be following the race starting tomorrow, like the real race, out on the trail. Where are you headed anyway?
I'll be leaving from Anchorage on Sunday, not long after the restart in Willow. I'll be heading out to the Squintna Lodge. It's one of the first checkpoints the mushers pass through. Staying there before I head on to Nikolai and then a little bit further up the trail.
My coverage starts about 300 miles into the trail at McGrath. That's when teams are starting to take their 24-hour breaks and have the Alaska Range behind them, but where the real racing begins.
And the race really is not going to be shaping up for a few days between time corrections for your start order, your mandatory rests, and where you're going to take them and all that stuff. We will be excited to hear from you guys coming up and talking about some of those folks back in the pack just dealing with the race itself. It's a big deal to try to go all the way across Alaska on a dog sled. Gentlemen, be safe. I'll be looking forward to hearing your reporting.
Goodbye, Casey. Goodbye.
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 And to the listeners, our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy trails.
Goodbye.
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 ASMR.
Goodbye.
Dogs.
ASMR on YouTube videos. Goodbye.
I like the dogs because they're soft.
ASMR.
Jinglets.